Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekdays at 9 and 11 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. This hour, candy and cranberries, cheese and coffee, those are just some of the items that Canada, Mexico, and the EU will slap surtaxes on in retaliation for President Trump's tariffs. Not to mention what's going to happen with soybeans. Did you know that 3 out of every 5 rows of soybeans planted in the U.S., many of them right here in the upper Midwest, are exported? That's a calculation from the New York Times. China buys a lot of those soybeans. A lot of them are grown right here. And China is angry about new tariffs on its exports. Nebraska Republican Ben Sasse recently told the Washington Post, "This is dumb. Europe, Canada, and Mexico are not China. We've been down this road before. Blanket protectionism is a bit of a part of why America had a Great Depression." Now, to be clear, some Minnesotans and American workers are already benefiting from the tariff hikes. Mining companies in northern Minnesota have already called people back to work. Iron ore production may boost the economy in some of our Iron Range towns, and steel manufacturers in places like Illinois and Ohio are hiring. So how to understand what this new world order of trade looks like now? And as our guests join us, I'd like to hear from you, particularly if you work in an industry that will be affected by this. If you live and work in northern Minnesota, will your town or your household benefit from these tariffs? If you farm, how do the surtaxes look to you? So call in if you work in an industry that will be directly or peripherally affected by increased tariffs. Maybe you work in some of the mines, maybe you live in some of the Iron Range towns, maybe you're a farmer. How are these tariffs going to affect you and your household economy? Here's the phone number, 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, on Twitter, at CarrieNPR. Pradhna Joshi is the trade and ag editor for Politico. And Pradhna, if I remember right, you prefer PJ, is that right?
Yes, most people call me PJ.
Really good to have you back on the show. Thanks so much.
Sure.
Mary Lovely is with us. She's a professor of economics at Syracuse and a senior fellow at the Peterson Institute. And she's with us from D.C. And Mary, welcome to you. Good to have you on the show.
Thanks. Glad to be back.
Mary, on Friday, the Trump administration released a list of Chinese goods that the U.S. will raise tariffs on. Would you be able to actually take something from that list and say, here's what this means? I want to make this real for our listeners. How can we do that?
Well, I think that it's a diverse basket, but they did try to hit what are considered to be intellectual property intensive industries. That is supposed to hurt Chinese firms who allegedly steal technology from the United States. The problem with this in reality is that they're mainly hitting multinational supply chains, which means that they're hitting a Foxconn, which makes iPhones for Apple, or Samsung, which makes TVs, which are then sent to the United States and Europe. So they're really hitting the offshore affiliates of our allies. And that raises the cost not only for U.S. firms that use those to make our own exports, it also hurts American consumers.
So I think I hear you saying this is a little removed from some of the issues that I'm suggesting will affect our economy here in the upper Midwest, that many of the items are not going to be directly, the tariffs aren't going to be directly felt. Is that right?
They won't be directly felt, but they will be indirectly felt because the manufacturers have to pass those costs on. You mentioned that some steel mills are hiring. At the same time, there are job losses that are happening in steel-using industries, or those industries are busy asking for more protection. So instead of really asking the most important question, how do we raise productivity in our steel industry, we're kind of redistributing the chairs on the deck. That is, where some jobs are being gained while more jobs are being lost. So this is something we know over time from experience, and yet it is the policy that's being used.
So, PJ, let's pull that out a little more. So if you, as I suggested, if you live in an Iron Range town here in northern Minnesota, they're hiring, and this looks good to your household budget. If you work for a company that uses steel, they may not be hiring, and they're pretty worried about what this means. Why?
Well, there are actually going to be tariffs on goods that companies that use iron will require. For example, if you're a dishwasher maker somewhere in the Midwest, you need parts from various parts of the world. There's not one country that specializes in all of the parts that you need that go into a dishwasher. And conversely, if you are a farmer, you're going to probably feel it in two ways. One, the tariff list includes a lot of equipment that farmers need. It includes haymaking machines, poultry incubators. It includes other machines for sorting grains. So if you're a farmer, you know, in any of those sectors, you're going to pay more for your equipment. And Minnesota, you know, is a big producer of agriculture that is exported, not just soybeans, but also pork. There's already a lot of tariffs that have already been put on pork by China in retaliation for other trade actions against the United States. So pork farmers are, as of early April, already feeling the effects of tariffs. And pretty soon, other agricultural industries, such as soybean makers and other goods, are going to start feeling it as well.
Okay.
So overall, as the economy of Minnesota, how many more jobs are you creating versus how many more jobs are you losing because you're exporting less?
PJ, I want to follow up on what you just said, though, about pork farmers. So can you, if your items are going to be more expensive, can you go, and China is not, you're going to lose market share in China, are there other places in the world that you can go out and make up the difference? Or are you really going to feel this the longer it goes on? Just in that single example.
Well, just to take pork, for example, the second largest export market for pork is Mexico, and Mexico is already promising to retaliate against the steel tariffs by targeting certain pork products, not all pork, but, you know, certain things like cured ham and things like that. So you're already hitting the two biggest industries. Are you going to be exporting, you know, pork to countries like Indonesia, which are Muslim majority? No. So you can try to find other places that will buy your pork, but you know, these are the two biggest economies where the United States exports pork to, and it will take some time to make up for it. But even then, you have to create demand in places that may not already have demand for pork.
And Mary, here's a similar question about soybeans from Mark, who says, if the U.S. loses the soybean market, would it ever come back? If the producers in Brazil get their toehold on the soy market, will we ever get those markets back?
Well, we'll get new markets. Will we get markets back in China? Perhaps. There was a reason why soybeans were preferred by China in the first place. But we won't get them back as long as the tariffs remain on. And one of the issues which we're concerned about with this particular tariff action is that it's under Section 232 of U.S. trade law, which means it is for Section 301, which is it allows great discretion to the president, and we have no idea when they would ever be removed.
By the way, I want to let you know, as we talk about tariffs and trade and what it means here in Minnesota and the upper Midwest, we're also getting a Supreme Court decision that affects Wisconsin here in the upper Midwest. And the Supreme Court was ruling on that partisan gerrymandering case. And the Associated Press is reporting the Supreme Court has ruled against Wisconsin Democrats over the legislative map. It is leaving open the broader issue of partisan redistricting, also ruling against the Maryland GOP over congressional districts. We'll have more information on that at the top of the hour in news, but wanted to let you know that the Supreme Court has made a ruling on that Wisconsin gerrymandering case. In the meantime, our discussion with Mary Lovely out of the Peterson Institute and PJ Joshi from Politico, where she's the trade and ag editor, about trade and tariffs and some of the developments over the weekend and what it's going to mean to household economies and state economies here in the upper Midwest, asking you, if you live in northern Minnesota, is your town or household benefiting from these tariffs? Has somebody gone back to work in your household? Are you feeling more flush? Are the mills hiring up there? If you're a farmer, are you watching some of these tariffs, the back and forth over these tariffs, with a certain amount of consternation? Tell me how this looks to you. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, and on Twitter at Carrie NPR. Call here from Peter in St. Cloud. Hey, Peter, what do you want to know?
Yeah, I just wanted to ask the guests their thoughts on the fact that it was that Trump actually is concerned enough about intellectual property theft by China to do something when there's been 20 years of rhetoric. It drives me crazy that he's the one doing it. I didn't vote for him, wouldn't vote for him next time around. But in point of fact, this has been talked about for so long. And maybe it's the Walmarts, Targets, and Amazons of the world that lobby our government not to do anything with China. But it seems like this is really the first time anything's been done.
Okay. Mary, what would you say to that?
I would say that we do have issues with China on intellectual property theft. Some of them can be handled by U.S. law. For example, if you go on to the FBI website, you can see that the U.S. is doing a lot about theft that happens in the U.S. Others can be handled through law in China, even, believe it or not, and through the WTO. But there are issues that go beyond those institutions, and clearly that is something that we need to work bilaterally. The question is whether these unilateral tariffs are actually getting us there. And I think what we're beginning to see is that it's not. The dialogue between the two countries is basically unproductive at this point. There is no serious negotiation going on in having China change policies. In fact, the U.S. hasn't even outlined specific policies that it wants China to change. It has said, we want you to stop doing what you're doing. But we need to say, these are the policies that we want changed, and we're going to follow up and monitor you and make sure that they are changed. That conversation's not happening.
Mary, it is part of the reason that we have this huge trade imbalance with China, because U.S. manufacturers send raw materials to China, then China assembles them into products and sends them back to the United States. Am I right on this? And then the finished products are counted as imports? Explain to me how this works.
Well, I'd say that you've captured part of it. The other part, of course, is that we send raw materials and semi-finished goods to other parts of the world, who then send them to China, and then China sends them back to us and to the European Union.
Okay.
So the global economy is churning, and oftentimes China's the last set of hands to touch the product before it arrives here. For example, we know if you buy an iPhone, you can track its process, track its path as it makes its way back to your house, just by tracking the shipping. And you'll see that that product, which has important American content, supports many jobs in the United States, is entirely attributed to China's exports, even though it has content from the United States, from Japan, from Korea, from other places.
Call here from Elliot in the Twin Cities. Hi, Elliot. Your question.
Yeah, good morning. My question has to do with the use of subsidies.
Good.
To reduce the effect, the negative effect of tariffs. Of course, there's a lot of assumptions there. One, that gaining jobs is good and losing jobs is bad. I think we can all agree to that. But we use corporate welfare in many other industries for whatever reason, and let's assume that that's good. Then wouldn't using subsidies to reduce the impact of these tariffs for the losers of the tariff war,
right,
help
have a positive effect, right,
so that you can have winners and less of a loss?
What do you think, PJ?
Well, I was going to say that is one of the promises that the Trump administration has made, is that they said that they will help make farmers whole if they are hurt by retaliatory tariffs. So far, we have not seen what kind of a plan the administration is going to put forth. When we've asked them, pressed them on it, they say, well, it's too soon to say. But again, like I said, there's already industries that are feeling the direct effects of tariffs, mainly specialized nuts and cranberries and other dried fruits that are exported, as well as pork. You know, most pork producers will tell you that they're going to lose, on an annual basis, billions of dollars for the whole industry. So if you're just talking about pork alone, that's, you know, billions of dollars of goods. And if China carries through on the retaliatory tariffs for the ones that were announced on Friday, that's going to be another $50 billion. So you just keep adding and adding and adding, again, back to the deficit problem. You keep adding to the U.S. deficit rather than making the United States more productive. Now, would that money be better spent retraining, you know, people for other industries that are in demand? Maybe. But, yes, this is going to be this is sort of what happens in a trade war, that there's constantly cascading effects, you know, and you're constantly trying to counter, you know, one effect to the other. And the other problem is also it's not just about China. I mean, this latest tariff action was about China, but the Trump administration first started out by attacking steel from almost all parts of the world, and not just China, including Canada and Mexico. And those tariffs are going to come pretty soon at the beginning of July. So we're going to be fighting a war on many fronts. So, again, that's going to add up to billions of dollars in trying to make various industries whole. So is it more strategic to try to do something that, you know, gets us away from some of these wars, or is it more strategic to spend on compensating people for these wars?
PJ, just some quick context here. If didn't more farmers turn to planting soybeans because the bottom basically fell out on the prices for corn and wheat? I mean, isn't that why we have such a supply of soybeans? Do you know?
Well, over the last 4 years, there has been actually about four to six years ago, commodity prices were very high, and at that time, there was trying to get more bang for the buck. But then over the last 4 years, the cost of producing corn and wheat has fallen, you know, sometimes below production costs. So, yeah, soybeans had a higher dollar value, you know, per unit, however you measure it. So that's where some farmers did plant soybeans. But there are certain regions that are better suited for certain types of agriculture. So, you know, in Kansas, they don't have as many soybeans as they have wheat, whereas in Minnesota, I think it's a little more flexible, where there was a lot more switching going on. But, you know, commodity prices were quite high just 4 years ago. And, you know, now it's not the case. So a lot of it has to do with a glut. A lot of it has to do with not being able to find new markets for some of the goods. But it's, you know, it's a cyclical cycle. And actually right now it's the feeling is that corn prices have sort of stabilized. The USDA has projected that corn prices might even increase just a tad bit over the next year. But again, this is probably where we are at. You know, you're not going to see a huge growth in corn prices that's going to turn people away from soy and back to corn necessarily.
PJ Joshi with us from Politico and Mary Lovely with us from the Peterson Institute. And we are talking about the effects, the real effects in our part of the country and beyond, from this tariff back and forth tariff, I don't want to call it a war, but dispute at the moment between the Trump administration, China, Mexico, the EU, and Canada. We haven't even talked about Canada yet, and I want to do that. Weigh in as what this might mean for your own household economy or the larger questions you have about this. 800-242-2828, wherever you are in the region, 651-227-6000. And on Twitter at CarrieNPR, where Joanna says from Winona, the fact that we ship so much factory-farmed pork to China is itself a huge problem for family farmers, rural communities, the land and water. Don't let corporate ag interests speak for farmers. And to the phones here to Whitney in Moorhead, Minnesota. Whitney, what do you want to know?
I want to know how long it will take for these very, if something's going to increase in price, how long it will take for these various products on the shelf to actually go in price. And
all
I also want to make a reminder that these tariffs are taxes, and these Republicans say taxes are bad. Tariffs are taxes.
Okay, Whitney, good question, though, about the price impact on the shelves. Mary, what would you say to that?
Well, I think we're already seeing increases in steel and aluminum prices. It's a little hard to sort that out from changes in supply and demand, but we're seeing it move through the economy fairly quickly. I think we'll see increases fairly quickly in other areas, particularly those that hit consumers directly, that is, without going through the manufacturer first, as when the tariffs hit parts and inputs. So, for example, if we do get auto tariffs later this year, we'll see the prices of automobiles, new automobiles, as well as used automobiles, all prices will go up fairly quickly, as we saw in the 1980s when we had voluntary export restraints on Japanese automobiles. So these prices will hit fairly quickly.
You're already seeing it in dishwashers. One of the early actions of the administration's trade war was imposing tariffs on washing machines in January, and we're just starting to see, you know, the lagging indicators showing that the price of washing machines has gone up between 6% and 10% in the United States because of those tariffs, and some of that was done to protect domestic manufacturers such as Whirlpool, but some of it was also done to attack foreign manufacturers such as Samsung. So, but you are already seeing the prices show up in washing machines. And in some respects, you are going to see it on other goods that take a while to make. One of the biggest manufacturing industries in the United States is for recreational boats, the ones you probably use on many of the lakes here.
Yeah.
They're made in Indiana, and they need aluminum sheets. And, there isn't enough aluminum in the United States. Most of the aluminum we use in America is recycled aluminum, which is a good thing. But a lot of it, you know, what happens is the used aluminum from the United States in terms of cans or car parts is shipped over somewhere where it's cheaper to, you know, smooth out and recycle, and then shipped over as aluminum sheets, and then manufactured into a high-value product such as recreational boats in Indiana. So they are already seeing the price impact of aluminum going up in places where you see manufacturing taking place. And so as a result, either people are going to start buying used boats, or keep not buy a boat this year. They might just say, "Oh, this is not a good year to go fishing," and there might be other alternatives made. But a big manufacturing base is in Indiana that relies on imported aluminum.
We buy a lot of boats in this state. To the phones here to Scott in Pelican Rapids. Hi, Scott. What's your question?
Hi. I'm just curious about the tariffs that have already been in place for many years on things like dairy products going to Canada, the lumber industry, things like that.
All right. So, Mary, tariffs that are already in place in the way that Canada is protecting its dairy industry.
Well, this is, of course, an issue that President Trump has brought forward. But the average tariff rates in Canada are very low, about 3%, just slightly above U.S., which is about 2.4 or 2.5%. Japan's tariffs are actually below the United States level. So on average, tariffs are extremely low. It's not what is, causing trade frictions. There are, however, a few products that every country has a certain special feeling for. In Canada, dairy tariffs are quite high, even though the U.S. does export a lot of dairy to Canada. In the United States, we've had an issue with their softwood lumber. We also have very high trade restrictions on importation of sugar. So each country does have a small set of goods which they protect, and those could be brought down in you know, additional trade negotiations. For example, if we were part of the comprehensive trade partnership, the follow-up to the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which the United States was part of, but President Trump pulled us out of, if we were part of that, we would have better access to the Canadian market, the Australian market, and other markets along the Pacific.
Mary, a question.
And also, I was going to say the one other thing about dairy is it is true that Canada has pretty much had a supply management program where they literally control how much farmers can produce in terms of dairy and also controls how much they can import of dairy. But one of the biggest export markets, again, for our dairy products, especially cheese, is Mexico. You know, so when we think about NAFTA, it is a three-country deal, and there's so much demand in Mexico for American dairy products that if some of the farmers that would come to lobby in Washington have told us, you know, even though we really hate the Canadian policy, we would rather give that up in order to preserve the Mexican market, because the Mexican market is so huge that, you know, we're willing to let that go if that's what it costs.
Yeah.
So there, you know, again, you have to think about it in a global sense.
Mary, I didn't know this about Canada until I read Laura Dawson's writing from the Canada Institute at the Wilson Center. And she wrote, Canada is the largest buyer of U.S. exports, more than Britain, China and Japan combined. Yes. Wow. And she says a weaker Canadian economy translates into reduced Canadian demand for U.S. products.
Well, that's true of both. That is true of Canada. And Mexico is also an important partner for us, as PJ just noticed, mentioned. So I think that we have to look at the NAFTA countries not just as, you know, places where we buy, the United States buys from, but also places where we sell a great deal. So, for example, U.S. exports of trucks, the number one country is Canada, and the number two is Mexico.
Jeez. PJ, I don't know if you were working this beat back in 2002, but George W. Bush tried something like this on steel, didn't he? And weren't there some job losses that resulted from that?
Yes. The Bush administration did try to use the same law, actually, the 232 law, to attack. I mean, even back then, there was a huge glut of steel, but ultimately, because of the counter tariffs that were imposed, and ultimately the United States was found to be in violation of trade laws, so the United States had to recompense, you know, under the WTO system, the people who were hurt by the steel tariffs. So that's why it was not necessarily considered a great thing. You know, whether the Trump administration really cares about what the WTO thinks will be another story. But yes, this is the reason that there are global trade laws, is because you don't want all these countries imposing all these tariffs unnecessarily without having some justification for it. You know, in the case of the latest investigation, the 301, you know, most people say the United States is right, that China has been stealing intellectual property and has been forcing technology transfers. And, you know, a lot of American companies that go to do business in China have to form joint ventures with state-owned Chinese companies.
Right.
And they have been discriminated against. But is the right way to attack that by imposing tariffs on haymaking machines, you know? Or, you know, some of the things on the list make perfect sense, like nuclear reactors and nuclear equipment. You know, that was a direct, you can see how there's a direct connection in trying to protect U.S. industries and making sure that China doesn't get a hold of some of those valuable industries. But some of the other things that we may not make as good of products of, you know, it might be better to import from overseas. This is sort of a simplistic example, but just think about something like, you know, orange juice from Florida versus wheat from Kansas. Now, you could really, really, if you wanted to, grow oranges in Kansas with greenhouses and a lot of other costs.
Mm-hmm.
And if you really, really wanted to, you could grow wheat in Florida, again, with you know, somehow getting around the hurricanes and so forth. But it makes more sense for Kansas to concentrate on growing wheat and Florida to concentrate on growing orange juice and having those two states trade.
Right.
So that's sort of what trade is supposed to be about. But of course, when people are doing unfair things like stealing your intellectual property, it does make sense to take action against them, but you also have to get your allies so that they can't get, nuclear reactors from France or from other parts to join you in the action. So it has to be sort of a collective pressure, and that's sort of why we have organizations like the World Trade Organization and other institutes to try to, protect that.
PJ, I know you're in Brussels. I look forward to seeing what you're writing about this from the international perspective. Thanks so much for spending some time with us this morning. Appreciate it.
Sure. Appreciate it. And thanks for having me back.
Mary, here's a policy question from Diane in Edina, who says, Trump's policy is based on the assumption that a trade deficit is a bad thing. Is it actually a bad thing, or is there a time when it's positive?
Well, we have to distinguish between a bilateral trade deficit and an overall trade deficit. The overall trade deficit does represent, the extent to which the United States is spending beyond its means. Now, that could be good if we're mostly investing it, just like, some of us go into debt to help our kids pay for college. We think it's a good idea if our child are going to have a better future. So how we feel about a deficit really depends on what we're doing with the money. Who exactly, whether I borrow, get my son's student loan from Bank A or Bank B really doesn't matter in that calculation of thinking of whether I should take on this debt. As you mentioned before, China happens to be the last hands that touch a lot of products because it's where finishing activities or assembly activities take place.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're, in a sense, left holding the bag. We talked about the iPhone. We know that China's value added in the iPhone is much lower than the total value that gets charted as their export. So I think it's a very bad metric, the bilateral deficit, for thinking about the value of this trade. I also want to just go back and talk about something PJ said, because it's an area that I do a lot of research on, which is about the joint ventures and intellectual property theft. When you think about what the tariffs are hitting, as I mentioned, they're mostly hitting the Samsungs, Foxconns. It's not hitting the Chinese companies, which the Chinese government is trying to bring up to be competitors with the West. It is hitting joint ventures. It's kind of like saying to joint venture partners, you were mistreated by the Chinese, so now we're going to sock you in the head to make it better. It just doesn't seem to make any sense. The Chinese are also very rapidly reducing the number of industries in which you have to have a joint venture to invest. So it also seems misinformed. There are some sectors where we're clearly concerned about and where we're where they're still requiring joint ventures. We should be focusing on those. We should be joining with our allies and talking to the Chinese directly and talking to companies directly about their experiences and looking for ways in which we can change Chinese policy effectively.
Okay, so just so I understand what you just said about these joint ventures, these are American companies that are required to be in joint ventures with Chinese companies, and that's where the transfer of intellectual property happens. And you're saying these tariffs go right to those American companies that are in these joint ventures with these Chinese companies. Is that what you meant when you said it's like another slap in the head?
Yes, it's not just American, it's also German and Japanese and South Korean and Taiwanese, they're all our allies. So yes, those are the firms that we're slapping in the head. Now, when we look at the types of products which we are concerned about, the so-called future products that figure in China's Made in China 2025 initiative, these are things like robotics and advanced types of chemicals and pharmaceuticals. When we look at those are things that China is not exporting yet. They're aspirational. We want to make sure that our companies have a level playing field to compete in those areas. These are very important issues for the United States to work with their allies to make clear to the Chinese what our interests are, because this is about our future. Trying to hit today's, you know, use today's exports to hit tomorrow's exports, it just is kind of a fool's errand.
Yeah. Mary, thanks so much for the time and the insight. Do appreciate it. And here's Tom from Twitter to follow up on what Mary just said. A friend of mine owns a company that makes metal parts in Forest Lake. He said the most frustrating thing is pricing out projects because he has to figure out what the price he'll have to pay for metal 1 to 2 months out. And the price is fluctuating too rapidly. Hey, we started this hour, as we always do on Mondays, with a chat with the political junkie. If you missed that, it's right on the podcast. You can catch the junkie anytime. Search NPR News with Carrie Miller wherever you find those podcasts.
This was a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. To add your voice to our discussion, you can call in at 800-242-2828 or tweet Carrie at KERRI NPR. And if you miss us live, you'll find all of our shows by subscribing to this podcast. If you have questions, you can email us at talk@npr.org.